Right, well, good evening. We had a discussion before, and we said, well, postmodernism and social science, how many will that attract? We reckon 18. So thank you all very much for coming. We obviously have an extraordinarily attractive panel here. I have a little note here. It says it was written sometime before we knew how many people were going to be here this evening. It says it still stands, according to the inviter. Everyone is invited to attend the reception following this roundtable discussion. Anyway, it's being held in the senior common room, which is on the fifth floor of the old building on Houghton Street. I think it's going to look more like an occupation than a reception by the time everybody's in there. Well, I suppose to some extent, I'm going to introduce the panel in a second, but I suppose I should say that it's difficult to avoid a certain sort of sense of irony about all being gathered here to discuss the ways in which postmodernism might or might not have kissed goodbye to the idea of social science. I must say, I can remember sort of like it's almost something that Malcolm Bradbury might have rather enjoyed as the first scene of a novel. And I just remember, just a second while we're settling down, just a sort of a moment, a sort of rather personal story, which I can remember a rather admirable piece of deconstruction that Malcolm engaged in. I was with him at a university conference in Boulder in Colorado, and we were both on the same platform. He stood up and announced a very peculiar thing, because he said that according to the rules of fiction, the only ways in which particular characters in fiction could be generated was from real life. In many cases, of course, novels were said to draw upon real life. People claimed that they'd been represented in novels. But he drew attention to the peculiar case of me, of Laurie Taylor, because he pointed out that after he wrote The History Man, many of you may remember The History Man, a story of a sort of an adulterous, beer-swilling Marxist oaf. After he wrote this, Howard Kirk, after he wrote this, many, many people came up to him and said, "That's Laurie Taylor exactly, you've got him absolutely perfectly." And he said, "But the strange thing was, I'd never heard of Laurie Taylor in my life. In fact, I'd never heard of him at all, until one day he rang me up and asked him to write a foreword to a collection of his columns from THES. He said, "Now I'm of the opinion, really," he said, "contrary to the generally accepted fictional notion that reality gives rise to fictional characters, I think this is a unique instance of where fiction has generated a real living character, that Laurie Taylor had no existence prior to my fiction." And I noticed that the audience then proceeded to applaud, this, and they thought, and Malcolm then turned, took his pipe out of his mouth, and looked forward, and he said, "I want to congratulate all of you in Colorado on being the least ironic state in the union," with which the applause was renewed. Anyway, so that so let me introduce what we are talking about tonight. Our topic tonight, as you know, is about the effect, or have postmodernism and social theory, we were concentrating initially upon the postmodernism part of that question, destroyed social science. And in no particular order, let me just mention just a very brief, very impersonal biography of those people who are on the panel. Should I just say, before I introduce them again, this is a sort of round table discussion in which we hope we're going to have a great deal of participation from the floor and from the balcony, a great deal of participation, because we're not going to take a vote at the end. I mean, I'm very tempted to take a vote. I'd like postmodernism to be either dismissed or accepted by 106 to 109. But anyway, we're not going to do that. It's going to be, we hope, sort of like a round table, a sort of an open debate, open discussion. Kirsten Campbell, who's rather easily recognised as being the solitary woman on the panel, is a solicitor and barrister. She's a lecturer in contemporary social theory, socio-legal theory, feminism, psychoanalysis, and post-structuralist theory at Goldsmiths College, where she's also director of research in the research unit in law, justice, and social change. She's editor of the Journal of Lacanian Studies, and her book, Jacques Lacan and Feminist Epistemology, is published this year by Routledge. And Nicholas Rose, if you can just sort of indicate there's Nicholas Rose there, one from the end there, is a convener of the Department of Sociology here at LSE. He was originally trained as a biologist before switching to psychology and then to sociology. He's managing editor of Economy and Society, an interdisciplinary journal of the social sciences, and in 1989 he founded the History of the Present Research Network, an international network of researchers whose work has been influenced by the writings of Michel Foucault. And together with Paul Rabineau, is currently editing the fourth volume of Michel Foucault's essential works. He's published widely and his current research concerns biological and genetic psychiatry and behavioural neuroscience and its social, ethical, cultural and legal implications. And Ed Serger, who is here, is Professor of Urban Planning at the University of California and teaches one term a year at the LSE. He's a geographer, interested in the spatial aspects of social theory, globalization, and urban and region political economy. His major publications include Postmodern Geographies. His current research is involved with the new labor community coalitions that have been developing in LA, seeking spatial justice and with innovative approaches to regional governance and planning in Catalonia. Frank Furedi, on the end, is Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent in Canterbury. His current research interests include contemporary consciousness of risk and the sociology of contemporary rumours. He's a columnist for the Times Higher. By the way, I should mention the Times Higher. Times Higher, Times Higher, Times Higher. It's sponsoring this debate, Times Higher. He is a columnist for the Times Higher and has published widely. His books include Paranoid Parenting and Where Have All the Intellectuals Gone? I say long time passing images, I've said that. Anyway, where have all the intellectuals gone? Peter Abel is Professor of Management in the Interdisciplinary Institute of Management at the LSE. His research interests include entrepreneurship and takeovers and mergers. His papers include on the failure of social theory. And Max Steuer is Reader Emeritus in the Center for Philosophy of Natural and Social Sciences at LSE. He's author of The Scientific Study of Society, which was published last year by Kluwer. Now, what I'm going to ask them all to do to start off with, I'm going to give them I've got one other thing. This is a public lecture, as you all know, but the academics do have a tendency to forget that this is a public lecture. They're seduced by the fact that they are present in a lecture theatre. So from time to time, if there's any indications from any of you that we are becoming too impenetrable, too prolix or anything like that, if there's some indication from the audience that this is happening, I shall shout out public lecture in the hope, as it were, that we might return to slightly less esoteric sentences and rather less prolixity or whatever it is. It'd probably be me who's doing it anyway, so wave at me. So I'm going to start off by asking all the people on the panel to say what they mean or what they would regard or think of as postmodernism. And I think that I shall start without any particular. I may as well start, if I may, at the far. Would you mind if I start with you, Frank? Can we just come along this way? So I shall ask Frank if he would like to tell us what he thinks, what he would regard, and what counts as postmodernism, so that we can then manage to move to a consideration of whether what he describes is in fact injurious to social science. Frank.
Well, I think the main problem is that whenever you read postmodernist literature or you encounter individuals who are roughly within that tradition, they will all make the point that there isn't really a postmodernist theory, and quite often you'll get, as you do in counseling, for example, 100 different definitions or approaches to the subject. And I prefer to see postmodernism as a mood that reflects our times. In many respects, what's interesting about postmodernism is that it's a way of making sense of a period of uncertainty, of fluidity, that we're kind of fairly conscious of. And I see postmodernists as essentially theorists who've got a peculiar strategy of making sense of that. And the kind of characteristics that I associate with those theories, above all, and probably my main objection to it, is an extremely feeble version of the human subject. I think postmodernism is fervently anti-humanist and regards human subjectivity in a very feeble form, and is very critical of what they consider to be the Enlightenment human-centered sort of vision. And if you look at postmodernist literature, there's continued snide remarks to the so-called Enlightenment project. That's a no-no. You know, if you're for the Enlightenment, that's seen as very passé, and some of that kind of dating leads to totalitarianism. Secondly, and very much linked to that, because obviously if you don't think very much of human subjectivity, are fairly intense questioning of truth claims. And in particular, the idea that there's a truth is seen as being absurd and something that cannot really be sustained. And part and parcel of this very skeptical, or I should say even cynical, orientation towards truth claims is, again, a reintroduction of a feeble version of knowledge, and the argument that knowledge, the kind of knowledges that we have, are first of all pluralized, and secondly, they only approximate sort of relationships up to certain kinds of points. And thirdly, very much kind of bound up with that, is the whole relativistic epistemology that kind of underpins this, which I think comes from German historicism. It's a very traditionally conservative orientation, which has been, in a sense, recycled in a slightly more radical clause. And I think if anybody wants to really understand postmodernism, you could do no worse than go back to 19th century German historic tradition, study the text, the emphasis on particularism, the hostility to universalism, and the revolt against positivism being kind of key elements of that irrationalist kind of reaction to the Enlightenment. So that's how I would see postmodernism as a mood rather than necessarily as a theory.
Thank you very much. Could I ask you, Nick?
Yeah, I mean, I should say first of all that I find a certain discomfort in trying to define this term. It's not one that I use myself. I know perfectly well what people mean when they talk about postmodernity, although I don't always agree with what they mean when they talk about postmodernity. When they talk about postmodernity, theorists are arguing that we've entered a phase in human history where at least in Anglo-European and Anglophone societies, some of the beliefs and understandings which underpin modernity have come into question. The belief in the universality of a certain type of reason has come into question. The belief in the absolute supremacy of the human subject and human nature and the certainty of identity has come into question. The belief in progress has come into question. The encounter between different belief systems has forced us to question ourselves, the conditions of validity of our own belief systems, and so on. So I understand what theorists mean when they say we've moved from an ethos of modernity to an ethos of postmodernity. And I understand what social scientists mean when they try to forge the concepts that are adequate to understand this new epoch, or this new mood, or this new ethos, as I would prefer to call it. Now, in trying to understand the emergence, the nature, the characteristics, and the consequences of these ways of thinking and acting, acting on ourselves and acting upon others, there's no reason for theorists and investigators to abandon the principles of reasoned argument, of the use of evidence, of empirical support for their data, and so on. In fact, sometimes I wish that some of those people who talked about postmodernity would explore the historical limits and the geographical variations in the forms of changes in ethos that they're identifying. But there's no reason why they shouldn't do that, using all the canons of rigor that we've come to associate with Enlightenment. And indeed, the figure with whom I most closely associated, Michel Foucault, although he pointed to the historical variability of knowledge claims, which is an empirical fact, although he pointed to the historical variability of conceptions of identity and self, which is a historical fact, although he pointed to the historical emergence of a period of belief in progress and its waning, which is also a historical fact, although he pointed to all those things and the empirical variability of ethics also can be attested quite empirically. He did so using standards of argument, evidence, and rigor, which I think were impeccable. So I would prefer to be a theorist of the variability of these belief systems, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm on the side of something called postmodernity, which, as I say, I think is often conjured up in the minds of enemies rather than in the minds of actual people doing bits of investigation.
Thank you very much. Can I just check that everybody can hear all right up there? Is that okay? I don't know what the acoustics are like. We don't have quite enough microphones. You're all right, are you? You're here. Okay, everybody all right. Thank you very much. Max, could I ask you if you would like to respond now, or to give us your account, perhaps?
Well, it seems to me that the traditions that we're talking about are very different from what I take to be social science. The idea that that we just have the normal canons of evidence and so on, I just don't find that to be the case. In my book recently, I had a look at the mainstream journals over the past 10 years, and you just do not find postmodernist or social theorist papers addressing these issues. I mean, that's just a fact. It's just not in there. The looseness of it, the idea that Foucault is a man of precision, I find a very odd notion. In fact, one of the critics that wrote against my Telegraph article made the point that we live in a very confused and uncertain world, and therefore people should write in a confused and uncertain way. And they quoted Foucault as being a wonderful example of achieving that. Now, I think this is a very, very big mistake. First of all, we don't live in, there are no galactic changes that have changed the world that's completely different. The world is changing all the time. It goes on changing. And the idea that there was some moment 20 years ago when something happened, and as a result of that, that we now have to think in a different way, that's nonsense in my view. What we should try to do is to bring the best understanding that we can to the various problems and issues that we address. And I find the complex group of ideas that have a lot in common, I think, among post-structuralists, social theorists, and postmodernists, is just too vague to be of any use, can't address any policy issue, and in fact is very anti-scientific.
Thank you very much. I apologize for the sight lines here. I know you probably can't see much. I can't do anything about shifting this sort of great apparatus here.
But they haven't missed much.
My apologies to you. Could I ask Kirsten, could I ask you, would you like to contribute now and say how, perhaps you'd like to pick up on what has been said already and see how much it corresponds to your sense of what postmodernism is?
Well, I think I'd like to start by saying it's very interesting that a call for precision in the use of concepts is precisely a call that in itself is imprecise. So, what do we actually mean by postmodernism? This collection of ideas that is being referred to is in fact a rather inaccurate description of a very wide group of theorists in contemporary sociology and social theory. Very few of whom themselves would call themselves postmodern. So I think it's very important to start by being precise, indeed one could say the necessity for a referent here, in terms of what is being named by postmodern. So my own position, for example, is the necessity to distinguish between postmodernism as an extremely loose term that names very little and is intended to name a philosophical mood, which I think is actually inaccurate, and between what Nicholas was referring to in terms of theories of social change. And that is a highly empirical claim about how the social world has changed. Indeed, it is on the right as well as the left. So, for example, people like Daniel Bell, arguments around the post-industrial society and so on. So my own view is, if we are to talk in any way that is meaningful about what post-modernity means, then it cannot refer to the mood. It needs to refer precisely to a theory of social change. And that in itself is an empirical exercise if we want to make that kind of argumentation. So, no to postmodernism as a very vague general term, and I would like to have some names here as who is being nominated by this. But two, yes to postmodernity as a theory of social change.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Peter, could I ask you now if you would be so kind?
Yes, okay. I think the first thing to say is that I think postmodernism is really a philosophical issue at source. And, of course, I'm not a professional philosopher and therefore I'm not really capable of commenting on whether it makes a significant contribution to philosophical discourse, to use that favourite word. I'm a practicing social scientist. In fact, I'm a sociologist. And the first thing, of course, I encounter when I try and read the various postmodernists, I admit there may well be some issue about where we draw boundaries, who isn't a postmodernist, but putting that on one side at the moment, when I read these people, I mean, the first thing that strikes one, and of course it's been said many, many times, but it has to be said right at the beginning here, is the style of writing lacks clarity and rigor. And then I could find plenty of other ruder words, but it certainly lacks clarity and rigor. And one wonders why, because when one tries to penetrate behind the imprecise prose, one finds that the ideas that are being promoted appear not to be ones that would warrant upfront confusion. One naturally feels that there is indeed a tendency to mask the lack of deep content by a lack of clarity and rigor. Postmodernism, in my view, is just one of the latest approaches that attacks the whole notion of social science. I came to social science 30 years ago, and we've had various philosophies that are anti-positivist, and they've usually had a half-life of, I don't know, 10 years, and then disappeared. But I suspect that the core ideas in postmodernism, and we notice how slippery the people are on the other side already, but I suspect that the core ideas are, first and foremost, that empirical truth, that's empirical truth, not logical truth, perhaps even logical truth, but empirical truth is ultimately contestable. And I think, in fact, nobody will disagree with that, that the concept of empirical truth is a difficult concept. Indeed, Western philosophy contests to that, you know, from the pre-Socratics onwards. And so nobody should disagree about that. But when you compare the writings of Foucault, the writings of Derrida on that, with the writings of Kripke and the logicians and Carnap, etc., they are in different intellectual worlds. They are in worlds that in one case seem to me to be academically respectable and attains to the concepts of rigor that we'd expect in an academic community, and in the other case not. So I think that's the first issue. Of course, it then leads to an extreme version of postmodernism that in a sense says that all discourses are equal value. Because if your truth criteria are shaky, then of course it's very difficult to know whether this discourse is better than that discourse. And so we get that extreme version. We get then some adventitious arguments about there being no generalizations, no, to use the jargon, no grand narratives. And we get an attack on the notion that there might be an empirically neutral theoretically neutral empirical vocabulary. Now again, I think that's uncontestable. I don't think there's anybody in the philosophy of science or anybody in the social sciences that believe there is such a thing as a theoretically neutral vocabulary. My main objection to postmodernism is really the lack of clarity. I feel that when you actually strip away the language, there is very little there. And I would challenge the people that are going to support postmodernism tonight to actually produce some propositions that are postmodernist and in fact have some clothes upon them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think that I'm going to just return to the panel now and ask if anybody would like to come back and feel they've been misrepresented and would like to respond.
About it?
I presume.
I'm so sorry, Ed. I'm so sorry. My apologies. I have your name written down boldly in front of me.
It's rather difficult to ignore, I would have thought.
I'm sorry, Ed. Please.
Thank you. In the name of clarity, I guess, I will first protest a kind of reversion back to what Laurie started by saying we shouldn't do. And that is a kind of introduction of a simplistic polarization between the clear and the not clear, the bad and the good. I just want to reject this from the very beginning by saying something very clear based on the premises that were set out. Has social theory and postmodernism destroyed social science? Well, let me be very specific. I will personify social theory with its leading figure, in my view, Anthony Giddens, and I will personify postmodernism by two of its best, Jacques Derrida, who has elicited an extraordinary outpouring of vicious, silly dismissal in recent obituaries in the US and in Britain, leading to thousands and thousands of letters back, and Michel Foucault. Now, I will transpose the question. Has Anthony Giddens, Michel Foucault, and Jacques Derrida destroyed social science? And my answer is absolutely not. Right? I will then say, well, where do we go from here? And the question that rises in my mind is, why is there now a group of social scientists who are actively and voraciously attacking social theory and social science? Why is this happening now? I can begin to understand this by recognizing that there has been a large group of people who I wouldn't call postmodernists, although they are the ones that most often call themselves postmodernists, but who are practicing anti-modernists. That is, they are pure trashers and bashers of the modern paradigms that have evolved in the 20th century in social science as well as in scientific socialism, because Marxism has been under attack by the anti-modernists as well as postmodern critics. But I don't think if we took a vote on whether sloppy and badly done postmodernism is significantly worse than sloppy and badly done social science, that the outcome would be of interest at all. Both are done very badly by very weak and mediocre people. Right? Let us try to look at what are the most interesting and important strengths with regard to social science that comes from a segment of the best postmodern critics. And I've selected three who don't necessarily label themselves postmodern, but certainly are labeled by outsiders in conjunction to the so-called enemy of social science. My definition of postmodernism is one that focuses upon something that attracted me in particular by groups of scholars who were engaged in what can be broadly described as a broad philosophical movement that was engaged in an epistemological critique of modern science, modern economics, modern Marxism. In other words, the paradigms that have tended to dominate a variety of disciplines in the social and physical sciences, as well as in scientific socialism, into the 1990s. These were competing paradigms. There were already a mix there. Lots of people and philosophers and theorists have noted the weakness. But there was a systematic and powerful accumulation of a new kind of critique. Not entirely new. All of these ideas were there before, having to do with truth claims, the truth claims of Marxism, the truth claims of economics, the truth claims of physical science, of many of the physical sciences. And the question was that this was beginning to sort of question the foundations, not overturn them, not throw them away, and certainly not reject them. The rejection is the poor postmodernism, if you will, simply rejecting these disciplines and these paradigms because some weaknesses were found. But some weaknesses were found. Systematic critiques of the epistemology of these modern paradigms, well established, began to discover a number of critical silences, weaknesses, biases, problems, in the foundations of the paradigms. This doesn't mean that they should be thrown away, because this critique has to be seen as a constructive critique. Remember, that word is deconstruction, not destruction. And that is a very big difference. And there was an attempt at developing a constructive critique of all of these paradigms based upon these weaknesses. Now, the three that have been given the greatest attention have been issues of gender and masculinist bias in Western science and social science and Marxism, ethnicity and race as weak in understanding the implications of racism and racial divisions for empirical truths, and class, of course. Again, with Marxism, the kind of exclusive focus on class losing out on a number of other silences. Now, those aren't the ones that I have focused my interest on. What has been most interesting and important for me is to recognize the weakness with regard to questions of environment and geography and space in all of Western traditions in social and physical science. And I have been attracted to some of the power of the feminist and other critiques that have been comfortable with the postmodern label to develop my own ideas about the importance of space versus time, geography versus historical approaches, or indeed the idea of trying to make social science more spatial.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, I just ask, as I was asking before, are there people on the panel who'd like to come back fairly quickly just to respond to something that's been said that they felt? Just let me start with Frank, I think you.
I don't think that it's particularly useful to counterpose the debate in terms of social theory, the good guys, and postmodernism, the bad guys, or the other way around.
Sure.
I think for a start, I think it's important to recognize that the two are very, very closely linked. For example, if you look at Weber's fact-value distinction, already within Weber, you've got an idea of facts being the objective areas, you know, sort of where empirical research can be conducted vigorously, whereas values are left up to a different domain altogether. And the very introduction of this distinction opens itself up to the kind of relativistic epistemologies that are flourishing today. And I think it's important to realize that it's not the case that one side is very rigorous and the other one isn't, because a lot of what's called positivism is really just prejudice masquerading as numbers. And you often hear that when you read the newspapers, people say, as research shows, you know, sort of one out of four people are suffering from this. And that's not particularly rigorous, but it looks rigorous because it's got a numerical element to it. And similarly, within postmodernism, there is a critical moment. I think there was a time when some of these developments in the 60s and the early 70s had some potential to provide a real critique of contemporary society. But I think where people like Derrida and others, you know, sort of in a sense went wrong was actually, you know, sort of instead of just merely contesting truth claims, which I think is a legitimate enterprise and something that is, you know, well worth pursuing, and any critical thinker would be doing that, at a certain point, the questioning of truth claims became something that became an end in itself and dismissed truth claims altogether. And I think that's really the unfortunate element within postmodernism. But there is within that a critical moment, which I think is quite valuable. You know, and certainly I remember as a university student and as a postgraduate being, you know, finding some of the insights, you know, sort of quite interesting and quite suggestive. But it's when that turns into an epistemological sort of free-for-all, unintentionally in many cases, that we're left with a situation where, in a sense, it becomes merely a kind of an uncontrolled mood that becomes playful and cynical and questioning almost for its own sake. So it's no longer critical, but it becomes uncritically critical. And I think that's, you know, where the problem is.
Thank you. Nick?
Yeah, two things. I find it hard to understand why people find it so disturbing to know that truth has a history, that truth has a geography, that truth is contested, that truth is bound up with power relations, that truth embodies systems of inclusion and exclusion. I mean, these seem to me to be historical and empirically demonstrable. And anyone who was working in the natural sciences would know that. For instance, in the area that I work, which is currently looking at the social implications of the life sciences and genetics, across the 20th century, a certain argument came into being around something called the gene, which was a unit of inheritance and a unit of development. Well, if you go and talk to any leading genomic researcher these days, they will not speak in the language of the gene. The language of the gene has been rendered redundant by the advances in genomics itself. They know full well that their truth has a history. So I don't see why people find that distressing or disturbing. To say our truth has a history can only be disturbing for those who have a bad conscience. Secondly, this thing about rigor. Well, one of the things that some of these writers who are being described here as postmodernists, one of the things that they wanted to get people to attend to were the forms of thought that formed the framework with which they understood their world. Now, to realize that your own thought itself is historical, has a history, came into being at a certain point and is going to disappear, to break through all that gives our common sense understanding that hold upon us, that is difficult. Thought is difficult. It is difficult to think. It's difficult to think if you're a theoretical physicist. It's difficult to think if you're an economist. And it's very, very difficult to think that the categories of your thought themselves can come into question. Some of the arguments that people are making about the difficulty of language are about people who are trying very hard to get you, through the act of reading, to question the way you think. Now, I believe that that's a valuable thing to do. I don't think that's anything to do with a lack of precision. I don't think it's anything to do with a lack of rigor, certainly not in Jacques Derrida or in Michel Foucault or a number of other people that one can talk about. It's a deliberate strategy trying to help you free yourself from the hold of common sense on your imagination. And that seems to me to be an admirable and indeed very enlightenment thing to do. When Kant writes, "What is enlightenment?" to try and explore the ethos of enlightenment, he's trying to do something very similar, it seems to me.
Thank you very much. Peter?
Let us all agree that, in a sense, history has a truth, that truth claims are difficult, demanding. As I said earlier, I think Western philosophy attests to that fact. Indeed, one of the central strains through Western philosophy has been around those issues. So let's not disagree about that, that truth is a difficult concept. I think we should be careful, though, when we think about the development of social science and the development of truth. Of course,
course, if we look at the history and the way we try to understand society, we have different models about latent mechanisms and how the world works, and some of those models supplant other models as time progresses. As we move across those models, the concept of truth itself does not fundamentally change. It's sometimes said, for instance, in physics, that the concept of truth changes when you move from Newtonian mechanics to Einsteinian mechanics. That's not true, it doesn't. What changes is the model that we have of the world. So what we can all agree upon is that truth is a difficult concept. What we can agree upon, that social scientists try and find latent models to understand complex phenomena, and in so doing, there will be concepts of truth that might ultimately be contestable. All that we agree on. The point about people that call themselves postmodernists, or better said, are called postmodernists, is that they write about these issues, and they write about these issues in a radically unclear manner. And it's no good that people on the other side of the table saying it's something to do with getting you to think by provoking you, etc. These people write in a way that is not acceptable, in my view, within the academic community. I think it is a moral disgrace that students are exposed to some of the texts that are, in fact, produced by these philosophers. One doesn't have to be preparing that, in fact, what Karl Popper said was that we have a moral obligation as academics. We have a moral obligation to be as precise and as clear as we can. With the best will in the world, you cannot say that of Derrida, you cannot say that of Foucault, you can't say it of that whole school. So why should we tolerate that? Why should we tolerate that when, coming out at the other end, there aren't any clear advancements in epistemology anyway? Everything that Nick has said, we all know. We all know that.
Peter, have you read Birth of the
why
Clinic?
Why should we expose students?
Have you read Derrida on Grammatology? Have you read these books?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're making these wild allegations about a moral disgrace. I mean, Birth of the Clinic, which is a study of a transformation in French medicine over a period of about 30 years, a beautiful book which took 5 years to write, which is based on very detailed empirical investigation. There's nothing obscure about that.
Well,
Grammatology?
You may well be able to find particular.
Well, I mean, this idea that this is
Francophobia. It's Francophobia again. British.
The fact is that I cannot.
It's you who's exercising the moral.
I shall have to start being a chairperson in a moment. Can we just take it one at a time? Peter, would you like to just finish your point?
Well, I can take large chunks of text from Derrida, Foucault, any of these people who care to be. I can put them in front of students and ask them to say, what does this mean? And most of them say, I don't know, it might mean this, it might mean that, it might mean so.
And they say differently of Kant.
Of course, that can happen in difficult things, in Quine, for instance, and in philosophy as
Papa.
Well. But then ultimately one feels that there's a way of adjudicating on those arguments and perhaps finding that in fact Quine would be quite clear, that one doesn't have any confidence that that's the case when one's reading something like Derrida. And I come back to the point that I think it is wrong that students should puzzle about these things, particularly if they're being taught social theory. I regard not just postmodernism, but I regard much that's written in contemporary social theory to suffer from this lack of rigor as well, and I think Max would agree with me, but that's not what we're quite here to debate tonight. But I do think it's incumbent upon, for instance, Nick to give me that specific examples of insights that come out of the postmodernist tradition that would enable me to understand the truth of history more clearly.
Can I just pick this up now here, because we do seem to be hitting a theme here, because we are talking about the ways in which postmodernism might be compatible with social science. We have that word science here, and one or two people have already referred to the testability of propositions, and one of the requirements is to say, does postmodernism, or the writings of those people who have been labelled postmodernists, generate what we would recognise from a scientific point of view as testable propositions? Because if that is the case, then it might seem that it is not antithetical to social science. So may I put that to anyone who would like to pick that up on the panel?
All right, you can take a little testable proposition, which comes from the writings of Michel Foucault, from an excellent book called The Birth of the Clinic, which was about the birth of clinical medicine, which argued that in a period from about 1790 to about 1820, the forms of organization of medical thought changed, and with that change in the forms of organization of medical thought, which linked symptoms on the surface of the body to some underlying pathology or lesion underlying it, that was linked to the emergence of pathological anatomy, that it linked to a whole new way of training doctors at the bedside, it was linked to the emergence of the hospital, and over the next 100 years or so, one sees the emergence of a form of medicine called clinical medicine, which was unknown before and is fading away now. Now, that seems to me to be a testable proposition. You can go to French medical history. You can say, okay, where, when? Was this the same in India? Was this the same in Britain? Was it the same in Ireland? Was it the same in the colonies? These are all eminently testable, and I think I'd love to have a large research grant funded by the Times Higher Educational Supplement or Professor Abel to go and employ some research students to test these propositions.
Okay. Further contribution on that one?
Well, I don't think that testability is the decisive criterion, because I think that the role of social sciences isn't to sort of kind of replicate a laboratory with kind of chemical experiments and come up with kind of quick fix results. The role of social science also is to be able to capture and reflect reality to concepts that yield to new experience, and in the course of yielding to new experience are able to capture in thought, you know, sort of important developments. And I think that's important. I think it's wrong to say that, you know, sort of postmodernism is this kind of dense, you know, sort of unclear theory that cannot do that, whereas social science is brilliant at this particular thing. I think that ultimately there is an artificial fiat to this debate, because in reality the two wings of social theory are to some extent mutually, you know, sort of interacting all the time. I think that what we got is a problem where social theory in general, including what's called postmodernity, is relatively weak at the moment in terms of developing categories and concepts that are able to reflect contemporary experience. And that's where we've got a very big problem. And I think the ascendancy of postmodernism means that, to some extent, this weakness is much more apparent there than anywhere else. And that's how I see it. I think, just to get back to truth claims, because I think that's an important issue that shouldn't be left untouched, I think that what Nick is implying, that somehow postmodernism is responsible for this fluid historical view of truth, is not the case. I think that's already evident within the whole notion of historical specificity that Marxism developed in the 19th century. It's already elsewhere, and I think that we already have, even in classical sociology, a very fine sense of historical specificity. And an understanding that truth is relative to social circumstances, it's relative to particular cultures. I mean, that's beyond debate. Nobody wants to actually contest that. The question is not that. The question is whether there's a truth or whether there are truths within a particular confine. And I think that's where the problem occurs, because certainly, you know, when you read sort of contributions by social scientists from the postmodernist tradition, there's continually a pluralistic notion of truth, which, in a sense, kind of and a situation of intellectual paralysis, and I think that's really what I find to be particularly frustrating.
Thank you very much. Question?
I'm just thinking about Ed's question around why, and this also relates to the argument about the seeming anxiety about the truth. And that's partly why I was insisting on the necessity for carefulness of concepts, because we are coming back to the philosophical arguments underpinning what are seen as postmodernism. So I think it's worth posing that question again. Why do we find Derrida so terrifying in terms of the moral outrage for our students, in a way that we do not find, for example, teaching Kant or Hegel or any of those philosophers that our students also would find difficult and not clear? So I'm wondering why, and I think the anxiety is of itself quite interesting.
I think philosophy is a very important and interesting activity, and I work with philosophers to a great extent. I also think doing science is an important and interesting activity. And while the border between the two is not absolutely sharp, the centers of gravity do differ a great deal. And when people claim to be doing social science and in fact are talking philosophy, even if they're doing it well, I think it's misleading. Of course, if they're going to do it really well, they would do it in the philosophy department. Nobody is going to do really first-rate philosophy and claim it's sociology any more than anybody's going to do first-rate sociology and claim it's philosophy. It's going to be weak philosophy that's going to be done under the guise of social science. Now, let me put a very specific question to you. It has been said on the panel that postmodernism is a theory of social change. What is that theory? I mean, you asserted that it was the theory of social change. What is that theory?
What I was arguing was, if we are going to use a term like postmodern, which is a contentious term, then we do indeed need to be precise. So, in the name of that precision, let's think about the usages there. And the usages are, one, to name the mood, the philosophy, and the second is to name a set of theorists who engage with arguments around the emergence of postmodern society. And that is a different kind of claim from the philosophical arguments, although it is true that certain theorists, and I think we should be specific and name which ones, like Baudrillard, Lyotard, for example, who is not a social theorist but a philosopher, for example, or Fred Jameson, who's a literary theorist, for example. Now, they are some of the few thinkers who would connect those two arguments, if we're going to talk about post-modernity as a theory of social change. But all I was trying to indicate there was we have to be careful about the content we're giving to these terms, not to collapse them and say one equals the other, etc.
Okay, I think I'm going to go out unless... Hey, do you want to... Yes, please.
I am part of the panel, I presume. I'm spaced out again. I'm disturbed by, again, repetitive stereotyping of both sides, and also the division between philosophy, and I know the central tendency. What's being squeezed out is something very fuzzy in some ways. It's not going to be definable in a very formalistic sense, and that is rigorous critical thinking. Whatever we're going to label it. What attracted me to certain people who are categorized as postmodern was that they would develop, and particularly Derrida, right, and Foucault, and indeed Anthony Giddens, was that they were developing systematically something other than just an occasional recognition of somebody being biased, certain empirical studies having some problems with certain kinds of issues. They were pointing out in a rigorous and powerful way systematic distortions of what was considered truth and paradigmatic formality, and arguing for a strengthening of science. I mean, quantum mechanics and empirical traditional science have tremendous contrasts with one another. And I don't think, I'm sure maybe there are a few quantum mechanics physicists who will label themselves and feel quite comfortable with the postmodern label. But these are also part of deep critical thinking, that we should not retreat to the safety of our traditional old paradigms because we see a fuzzy threat coming up. By the outsiders, we should try, and here's an answer to the question about avoiding the polarity, try to learn as much as you can, even though it's pretty difficult to read Derrida, try it, because there's something there that you could learn about management, or economics, or sociology, or geography, that there is something there. So I think we need to understand the power of critical thinking. And I called the postmodernism that I'm attracted to critical postmodernism or an epistemological critique. Now, epistemology, oh, that's philosophy. But these are critiques that are trying to develop, but not exclusively philosophy. The idea is, first of all, you have to be able to tell the difference. I've had people, I've seen you, in fact, Max, use as an example of fuzzy postmodern thinking one of the figures who is the most strongest anti-postmodernist in the field of geography, and that's David Harvey. You use David Harvey, who's usually one of the clearest thinkers, who is actively criticizing any postmodernism, has resisted any of the postmodern critiques, reconstruction of Marxist thought, and you use him as a postmodern. If you can't even tell the difference, then what about rigor? I don't know about rigor. I think what we have to recognize is the power of critical thinking, and I'm going to make a quick shift to the spatial and argue that this is also part of what I'm arguing. And because I'm stimulated by this, by all of the wondrous attempts to talk about the power of history and historical truth, I think the power of historical thinking has been one of the major reasons why we've lost touch with the importance of geographical and spatial critiques and critical spatial thinking over the last 150 years. From Kant and from Hegel, from that period on, we've become historicists, all of us, who are critical thinkers. And what I'm interested is injecting the spatial. And one of the most exciting examples, you want an example? I think one of the great figures today who will never label himself postmodern, but I think is being informed by this new spatial thinking, is an economist called Paul Krugman, one of the best public intellectuals today, and one of the leading figures in the development of geographical economics in a way that didn't happen in the past, and a creator critic of that government that I am part of back home, and one of the great economic theorists of the present. He's somebody that has learned from the postmodern critique. I'll give you a specific example, and is doing some of the most exciting work in the field of economics today.
Okay, thank you very much. I just say, Pete, can you be quick, and then we're just going to go to the audience, is that right?
2 points. I mean, again, nobody's going to disagree that we should be concerned with critical thought, and no, no, that's taken as axiomatic, it seems to me, in academic circles. What you've got to demonstrate is that the people that you wish to defend are offering us ways of reasoning and being critical that transcend the ways that perhaps Max and I think about critical thought. And I think you probably find that rather difficult. Again,
Paul Krugman.
Well, Krugman.
Krugman has nothing to do with postmodernism.
Absolutely.
Nothing whatsoever.
Look, you're absolutely wrong.
Look. No, I'm afraid. I've worked with Krugman a lot. I've been impressed.
That's right.
The fact that spatial economics was not very important 10 years ago and now is important is an interesting observation. There are probably good reasons in economics why that's the case. We don't need any appeal to anything in postmodernism to talk about that transition. In fact, trying to wrap that transition in the obscure vocabulary of postmodernism would, in fact, I think, detract from understanding it, not, in fact, enhance the understanding.
I just want to make one tiny little point. It's
very,
the,
very
it's the people who's on the critical side of this question who've invented this category of postmodernism, as it were, as it's used here, and have defined certain people into it and defined certain people out of it.
Yeah.
It is really a term of moral policing. As Peter Abel said, he's morally offended by certain people, and those people he's morally offended by, he's going to define as postmodern, and anybody you think might be halfway decent, like Krugman, he says, no.
Nick, please.
He's
moral policing, I like
it. Well, I think both sides are
right. Can I just ask the panel to be quiet for just a second, because otherwise we are now nearing 7:30, and that is the time when, in fact, I'm delighted to bring in people and questions. You might like to address your question or your point to a specific speaker, and then they can at least respond, and we don't have to have the entire panel responding to each one. So I think it was the gentleman in the third row from the back of the, if you say, yes.
Well, I work for a bank, so I feel like I'm entirely outside all of this discussion. And looking at it from the outside, it seems to me that what you're saying doesn't really address postmodernism. It's not really about postmodernism at all. On the one hand, we're told it's immoral and irresponsible to be talking about postmodernism. And on the other hand, we're told, well, frankly, almost nothing at all. I mean, everything that Nicholas Rose was saying just seems utterly vacuous until you put it into a context. All of this stuff about, you know, there's always historically contingent truth and always inclusion and exclusion tells us nothing outside of context. And that, I think, comes back to the very first point that Frank Urani made about the fluid notion of subjectivity in society today, back to the question of the subject in society. And I think whichever side of the debate you're on, Foucault would seem to me to be quite a good example of how to begin to address that. Because the only way I think that social science, broadly or narrowly defined, is going to be saved is by some kind of re-engagement with those questions. And rather than come at it with a large theoretical schema, Foucault just stepped back from what was already there, looked at the material, and just tried to engage with the society that he was in. And it was only towards the end of his life that he started to begin to concretize that to something that had then been picked up on as a rigid post-structural people on the right-hand side have been objecting so vehemently to.
Thank you very much. It's what I've always wanted in my life, a bank manager who understands context. would anybody like to respond?
I couldn't work out if I was being accused of being vacuous, but if I was being accused of being vacuous by a bank manager, I hope I wasn't. I think one of the interesting concepts that one might want to think about is the concept of profit itself. The emergence, the historical emergence, the difficulty of creating a concept of profit, the way in which that concept of profit was taken up, the emergence and linking of that concept of profit with certain practices of accounting, the emergence and linking of that with certain modes of taxation and so on. It seems to me there's absolutely nothing vacuous or, as it were, anathema to the bank manager about the emergence of these and the significance of these forms of trade. Now, is profit truth? Is profit the truth of trade? Or if I say that profit is a historically emerging, spatially distributed, differently conceptualized, constructed by accounting practices, if I say that about profit, am I being a nihilist, a postmodernist? What? I mean, this seemed to me to be a vacuous way of conducting the debate. We could have an argument about what profit is in the Islamic world versus what profit is in North America, or what it was 50 years ago for what it will be 50 years' time. That would be interesting.
Thank you.
Well, just a point on Foucault. I think Foucault, you're right, to his credit, does engage with society as he lives, which is why he so often has got so many interesting insights. But the problem with Foucault is what he did is basically recycle the subject in a very feeble, decentered kind of a way. And what we're left with is a subject as a powerless, non-history-making, essentially subject object of history rather than its subject. And I think that is really where where the difficulties begin.
I'm going to take another question.
I just want to emphasize the importance of context.
Sorry, Ed, we must just limit panel contributions, I think. I will come back to you in a minute.
I was finished.
Can I have the gentleman in the front of the balcony, please?
No,
could I have the gentleman in the front of the balcony?
Yeah, if I may, I would like to make a comment. I have a fairly good understanding of what it means to be an academic in the UK, and I know that you guys are underpaid. And that's okay.
Not this panel.
Thank you. We'll make a bet.
So what a better way of an academic, to write a book in order to interest his interest. And I thought that if you want to write I was a technical PhD book. So I thought that if you write a hardcore, solid academic book, no one's going to read it. On the other hand, however, if someone writes a book that is not very, logical, not very, not properly academic, everybody is going to read it. And that means, you will increase your income. And not only that, but the university that has, the person that wrote that book, will have more students. So it's like a market. So everyone is happy. The person that writes the postmodern book,
can we just put that to the panel then? The profitability of the obscurantism. Peter.
Well, I quite frankly, I have quite a lot of sympathy with that. If I'd written such a book, I presume I wouldn't be sitting here because I'd have to make my living this way. But going back to Nick, I mean, nobody's going to disagree that the history of the concept, the natural history of the concept of profit, is a very interesting topic. That the concept of profit has changed through historical periods, come to have different meanings at different times. All of that seems to me to be perfectly acceptable within what you might call the traditional canons of intellectual history or social history. The question is, what does postmodernism contribute to addressing that story? And it's not clear to me what the answer is.
Ed, I interrupt you.
I will now respond to that because I have my comment is a direct response that is related to a dismissal of the importance of the new spatial economics. The concrete critique is indeed the critique of the degree to which historical thinking blinds us, that just looking at what you call the natural, I don't understand that, natural history of profit without... and if you notice, almost every time that Nick talked about the historical, he also added the geographical, thank you, Nick, for my collegiality. But this indispensable—that's exactly right. Throw it in. This is what historians, particularly British historians, both on a more conservative side and British Marxist historians, have always forgotten the same kind of thing: the equivalent power of the spatial and the geographical. The physicists, the physical scientists, know this. They study space, time, and matter, with space and time being equal and interactive. Social scientists have traditionally, particularly in the West, for the past 150 years, have studied the society only from an hysterical perspective, without the space.
Quite right. Postmodern theory of geography.
And I've written, this is exactly what I've been writing for the last 30 years. It might be too difficult for you, but I think you would understand it up there. Yeah?
It's a chairperson's joy to try to control a loquacious panel, but I still have to try and do it to bring in people from the audience. We have somebody here on the end of the row there, please.
Yeah,
Kirsten.
Well, I'm just wondering what the question is.
Well, are people who are anti-postmodernist nuts?
I don't think that was the question. But I was trying to discern, for example, were you concerned that it was that, for example, in our discussion, that we were interested in why at this moment a particular anxiety and a particular moral register is emerging around
moral?
These questions.
I mean, moral policy,
language of moral outrage, for example, indicates a certain moral concern.
You can have a really systematic critique of postmodernism without being moralistic about it. I think
that's a complete red herring. So
you know, I mean, to accuse people who criticize you of moral policing is a very cheap trick. Right? It's got nothing to do with intellectual discussion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it sounds good, moral policing, but actually it's not about moral policing, it's about an intellectual debate. We're dealing with difficult concepts and we can be anxious. I mean, I'm anxious about the fact that because of these developments, we find it very difficult to have a common dialogue even to discuss. I mean, I think if you look at the intellectual world around us today, we've lost the ability to even debate because we no longer can even agree on the basic principles. And that's a problem because how can science and knowledge develop when we even haven't even got a common vocabulary? And there's a systematic attempt to destroy any project that tries to have a common vocabulary. And anybody that tries to do that is dismissed as being totalist or putting forward a meta-narrative or something like that. I am worried about that, and there's nothing wrong with being worried about it. Being worried is not the same thing as being moralistic.
I'm in favor of free and open intellectual debate. I am certainly not a postmodernist, and like Ed, I'm critical of much of the sloppy work that hides under that label, as I'm critical of much of the thought-blind empiricism that hides under the label of social science. So I'm an equal opportunities disparager of thought-blind work. So let's be clear about this. What concerns me about this kind of a debate is why it is that some people wish to police this debate out. Why it is that some people think the works of Foucault or Derrida or Habermas or whatever should not be taught to our students. It wasn't me who introduced the language of moral outrage. It wasn't me who wrote an article in the Telegraph warning parents that they shouldn't send their kids to departments where these kinds of things appeared on the reading list. It wasn't me who was exercising that kind of policing. Believe me, I would much prefer not to be on a panel discussing this mythical object of hostility. I'd much prefer to be on a panel discussing something which seemed to me we could have a decent kind of argument about.
May I take the question from over here?
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak a little louder? I think there's some people just in the balcony who can't hear you. Would you mind?
There are some mics. I don't know if anyone...
Yeah, there are mics here. Yeah. And we're so slow getting them around, but if we can, we can try it if you like. But one coming over to you. It just takes so long, and we always lose the impetus of the debate when this has to happen. But anyway, if you could just try speaking a little louder until the mic gets to you.
A moment for quiet reflection is always.
My question is just, to what extent do you think that an anti-foundationalist epistemology commits you to being a postmodernist? And the second one is, in whether you think or not that the paranoid Foucault, the Foucault's paranoia with power is in any help to understanding power exactly, because if everything is power, so is it still a meaningful concept or not?
Well, it's, can I just sort of just take one more and just ask people to pick up on that later, because it's quite a specific...
This ties up with the postmodernist concerns of exclusion. The problem is that you need exclusions, otherwise you could not think and you could not talk. So in what sense is it really helpful to talk that we have exclusions? And in some sense, they represent a danger.
This is a new policy of mine, not in any way prompted by your contribution, but I'm just going to take two or three pieces from... Can I have the gentleman at the back in red, please?
My question is, do we live in a postmodern world? And if we do, maybe that has some bearing on the problems of postmodernism. I mean, I sort of think that it's probably quite true that these grand narratives of truth and progress and universalism are problematic, but how does postmodernism help us to understand that? And I sort of think that there are insights, but where do we go from here? I think that postmodernist theories just tend to recycle that rather than actually going beyond it. In fact,
thank you very much. Can I ask the panel just to hang on to these questions and keep them in mind for their responses in a moment? I'll take, yes, please.
Just a question, Sue. I agree with what you said about the art of Foucault and Derrida being writing in a very unclear way. People understand. But I believe that they make a contribution. I was just wondering, do you not think that they make a contribution?
Okay, thank you very much. I'll take two more. Yes, please. So the gentleman behind you, yes.
May I make two points quickly? The first one is general and philosophical. It seems to me that the term postmodernism from this discussion is, in a sense, its principal meaning is that you need to do a rigorous philosophical analysis of the term. I don't think it's Shannon. It is an idea of language here, what it means. Implementing it in a certain context. Or you want to do an Austinian exercise, Jane Austen, how to do it. Unless you do that, you can't have any meaning with the stuff, that's one. The most specific point is on Foucault, there's a sharp polarization which has been picked up, very concrete, between Nicholas Rose and I believe Professor Max Stewart. Professor Rose, you said, number study is a very precise and objective base. That's actually true. You see, of course, in things like Fourier, James, and all. Now, the point, the truth is a bit more complicated. You remember that when Foucault was pulled up, he's very well documented by people like Paul Rabinoff and Hugo Dreyfus, that he got some facts wrong. He said, of course, I'm not a very good academic. He said, this is a rolling argument. And you remember the famous example of the shape of fools in the tradition in the European literature that the insane, the serpent of history, were put on ships and were then set to sail on the canals and seas of Europe. Now, you get this authority. Foucault used this in his theory, and some very naive historians like Villefort gave it to him. Foucault is naive and idiotic, but in fact, there is no such shape, you see? And yet, Foucault did get this wrong.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Let's. Foucault got his facts wrong. Okay. Let's. No. I know. I take your point. I'm just trying to get it as quickly as possible. So, can we not go into the details, though, of the evidence and middle thoughts and that whole argument? Because. Okay. Take the 2 points. Well, I just have the last point, the lady in front of you. Then.
Sorry.
No, the person in front of you. Yes.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to say I'm glad you raised that question, but I'm not. Because this question was raised by me with the panel, and it led to so many disagreements about what was meant by social theory that we eventually tried to conceal this concept from the debate. But you've raised it, you've lifted the lid. May I just turn to the panel and ask them if they'd like to respond to what they've heard so far. Peter, would you like to?
I'm not prepared to say there's nothing there. In fact, I think when Foucault is writing, doing social history, as Nick was describing earlier, I think he is quite valuable. What I fail to find is within the canon, broadly speaking, of postmodernism, some deep insights into how we might do social theory in a different way. I think the notion that we need to be critical, that truth is contested, all these things, in fact, are acceptable within traditions outside postmodernism, and I have no argument with those. I think social theory is an attempt to model latent mechanisms that account for theoretically described empirical facts.
Thank you. Anybody else like to come in?
Yes, correct. Can I just say a fascinating question on the relationship between the two? Because I think that what we call postmodernism, what we're roughly discussing, is inconceivable without the disintegration of social theory. And I think in many respects it's the failure of social theory to kind of evolve and interact with changing developments that has opened the way for a radically relativist epistemology. And in many respects I see postmodernism as entirely parasitical upon it, and through beginning with a potentially healthy critique of positivism, it then turned in on itself and benefited from the fact that social theory stood still and still continues to stand still. And I think, you know, we're left in a situation where we're essentially, you know, left with language games, playing around with literary metaphors, or with space. And increasingly use naturalistic and non-social forms of explanation to account for society, and I think that's terribly sad. I'm very happy that history is, you know, historical explanations didn't rely on space or naturalistic phenomena to account for. I think that's a much more rigorous way of making sense of human development.
I must jump in and say that the space that I'm talking about is actually socially produced space. It has nothing to do with what you're describing as natural environment. And therefore has nothing to do with the kind of critique of historicism that I was mentioning.
But it's underpinned by,
But I think what you're bringing up is one of the causes of the problem here around postmodernism, that's both in terms of the strength and viciousness of what's going on the anti-postmodern side, as well as some of the claims, and maybe exaggerated claims, on the supposed postmodern side about a kind of paranoia that's perceived. And that has to do not just with the poorly done postmodernism, but with what you referred to, Frank, several times, which I think is very important, and the problems of relativism and hyper-relativism. But I think you describe this too categorically as something inevitable if one somehow tastes of the postmodern stream, that one is going to be sucked into hyper-relativism and become a Feyerabendian, anything goes social scientist. I don't think this is necessary, but I think there is an underlying assumption that may be connected to some of the other kinds of debates about the philosophy of postmodernism, which sees only this slipstream into hyper-relativism as somehow inevitable. If you tip yourself over to postmodernism, watch out, you're sucked in and anything goes. You lose all truth. And I think this is a problem. I think it has to be recognized as a danger on the postmodern side, but it's not anything inevitable. And it's not something that you can stereotypically assign to postmodernism in any categorical or absolute way.
I do think that I take our work pretty seriously. And I do think that there's a lot of activity going on in university departments which is not of a reasonable standard. And if that's happening, I think we are obliged to say so. The idea that we have to be quiet. Now, I'd certainly say, well, it has been suggested that perhaps one shouldn't say things like that. Now, obviously, I favor I mean, it goes without saying, free exchange, open exchange, I may well be wrong, that may well be the case. But if one feels, as I do, that a great deal of work takes place, shoddy work, substandard, and actually deliberately confuses students, then I think one is obliged to say so. And I don't think there's anything untoward about that. I think one should come out and say what one thinks.
Thank you. Yes?
Well, I wanted to echo that last point, actually, because I wanted to ask if in what way does somebody saying don't send your children to such and such a university count as a form of moral policing? Are you being rigorous in your categories? Does MAPS have the power of the state? Does he represent a body of armed men? Do you not think that you're trying to close down the debate by even suggesting that that's so? And that Ed then puts the icing on the cake by suggesting that these are vicious and paranoid attacks?
Okay, thank you. Yes? A bit louder if you could.
Yes, we're talking about distortions. Distortions that were brought out by Jerry Bell's right. Now, that's all right, bringing out the fact that distortions are the truth that we speak about and accept as common sense today, but it seems to me that the discourse stops there. There's one thing recognizing that there are distortions today, but truth is. It's another thing throwing away the baby with the dirty bathwater. Maybe we should think of why there are these distortions. And how do we compare these distortions to the truth if we deny the existence of the truth at all? I mean, it seems to me that the anti-essentialist character kind of blocks the problem in itself. There's no way of coming out of it. There's no subject to do the search. Because we are desperate. There's nothing to be found anymore. And we're blocked in this uncertainty. We're not going to be found anymore. There are distortions, yes, and we're lost. But then, why can't we investigate the situation and go on and try to see what these distortions are? Maybe there are distortions caused by something in the society. Maybe we should look around and see what is going on and not just stop and be uncertain and desperate in the face of what is going on today.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think yes, Jeff. No.
Yeah, thank you. My question is actually inspired by what I heard just now, and it's very simple. What is good postmodernism? Because I myself try to grapple with applying some of these concepts that would probably fall under this category. But to me, the big problem is that while positivism or the social science has a measurable standard of what is good and bad social science, I think the really important thing is that postmodernists come up with a question and criteria to measure and define what is good postmodern work. And I think then among themselves they can have a discussion that is actually valued and also from the outside because they are able to identify different work.
Thank you very much. What I'm going to do is just take, if there's any more burning question, then I'm going to ask the panel, they'll just have about a minute each before we reach 8 o'clock in the end of this session, so to address these questions. So any burning questions? Yes, there's one over here on the left.
Deliberately confusing.
And deliberately confusing work should be criticized. Shouldn't you apply that to the story of Corky in your article?
Hold your horses on that one. And yes, thank you very much. In the middle, this will have to be, I think, the last one more. I've just got two more questions, and that will have to be it. Yes. Thank you. very much. And then the last, yes, thank you so much. Okay, thank you very much. We've got 6 minutes left to ask people to sum up and to incorporate answers to some of those questions, if I might. So, may I start with you, Kirsten? Do you mind?
Okay, just on the what do we do next and the post, what I prefer to call the post-foundationalist question as opposed to the postmodern epistemological question. Actually, there's been a lot of work done around epistemic norms, and here we can think of some very good feminist work. For example, people like Helen Longino, Lorraine Code, etc. Sandra Harding on strong objectivity, for example. So if you're thinking about where to and epistemic norms, etc., what post-foundationalist epistemic norms might look like, there's a host of work out there. And they're, I think, very useful places to start.
Do you want to add anything else to any other question? Because otherwise it'll be your last time I'm going to invite you to speak.
Only that I still maintain there is a slipperiness around these terms that does indicate a certain difficulty in thinking through the challenge of some of these ideas. And it's not to say that there's a moral panic, but one has to ask, why are these terms so slippery, for example, in the context of this debate? Why did they get rendered in certain ways and not others, filled with some content and not others? So that would be my final question.
Thank you very much. Peter, may I ask you to?
It
is your 1 minute, yes. Don't waste it.
I actually wanted this debate to be about social theory and not postmodernism. My view is that social theory itself is wanting. It doesn't accord with the canons of rigor and clarity that I think is essential to university life. I think postmodernism is an extreme version of this. And I support Max when he says that, in fact, we have a right to say this, and it's our obligation to say this. That a lot of what's going on in university departments at the moment under the name of both postmodernism and social theory, I don't think is acceptable, and I certainly wouldn't expose my 15-year-old son to it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Ed, can I ask you?
Yeah, I think just beginning very quickly about to reject false dichotomies, which is what we've been hearing over and over again. Shoddy is on both sides, good is on both sides, let's find the best and use it. This is the help that's necessary for understanding the contemporary world, which is a postmodern world. It's increasingly postmodern world, to answer one of the earliest questions, but that doesn't mean it's only a postmodern world. I am a postmodernist, I'm also a Marxist, I'm also a social scientist. I practice a multiplicity of subject matters using the best tools I can, rather than forcing things into either or categories of good and bad, and whatever they are, whether they are moral or immoral. I will even, although I agree with the intent of your question, I will reject the idea of labeling this one way or the other. This is bad categorical logic. And what we need is this selective combinatorial argument. Postcolonialism, to end with, is one of exactly the silences that have come out in terms of understanding the contemporary world. Feminism, a good radical Marxist, post-Marxist critique, if you will, and the post-colonial critique, and on my spatial thing I won't mention again, but all of these are attempts to deal with the real silences of bad social theory, which was not up to the challenge of the contemporary. And it's precisely these new directions that are producing the most exciting forms of social theory, new social theory and social science. And if I'm asked for an example, I need many more hours.
Frank?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, this is a postmodernist cultural moment. And I don't know, if Max wrote that article, I don't know where that poor parent is going to send their child, because virtually every university that I know of, you'll find that this kind of sensibility is very much the dominant mood, as it is in the South, because I think post-colonialism is in many respects a new version of Western, kind of ideology recycled for a third world, and I think that's sort of and is merely the most contemporary manifestation of that. What I would plead for is that, regardless of where one stands, is that somewhere along the line we're going to have to return to a form of discussion and controversy and debate, where people desperately try to develop a vocabulary and categories that are adequate to a proper dialogue. I think we're losing that habit, sort of quite seriously. I'm all for getting stuck in there and arguing and being extremely hard, but I do think we're losing this ability to exchange intellectual ideas. And as somebody working in a university, I really do despair because of that. Because one of the things that we ought to be able to do in a university and in an academic environment is actually to discuss and to discuss freely.
Thank you, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the questions were about Michel Foucault, and I'd love to have a long seminar on Michel Foucault, but we can't. I'll just say one little thing about Michel Foucault. Foucault was certainly not a postmodernist. I don't think he understood the word. When asked the question, he said, I have no idea what that means. What he was a post-structuralist, and that meant that he thought that human thought wasn't something created spontaneously out of the human imagination. It answered to structures which are external to the human being and binding upon them. That's a social theoretical term. That comes from Emil Durkheim. Are we to reject Emil Durkheim, or are we to put Emil Durkheim in the same box as Max Weber, as Jürgen Habermas, as Jacques Derrida, as Jean-François Lyotard? And what I find so worrying about this debate are the ways in which the categories are being formed, which are forcing the debate into what seems to me to be a rather spurious opposition. So I'd like to have this debate with a little bit more precision and talk in some detail about the particular figures that were there. I'll just make two other points. The first point is about the subject, which has come up on one or two occasions, and since I spent a lot of my time writing the history of human subjectivity, I ought to just say something about it. I don't think anything in these arguments is saying that human subjects aren't important. What these arguments are saying is, how have human subjects come to understand themselves and act in certain ways? How have their ethics been formed? How have their ways of relating to themselves been formed? How have their values been formed? How have their capacities been formed? These are rather important. You can't get away in the present by holding up the image of some humanist subject that somehow postmodernism has done away with. The humanist subject didn't do so well over the 20th century, can I just remind you? And you don't need to be a humanist to abhor what went on in Rwanda. You can know genocide without being a humanist. Okay, third point about relativism. There's a huge slippage here between epistemological and ethical relativism. The fact that there is history and geography to systems of thought does not mean that we are unable to judge. Indeed, human beings are the kinds of creatures who are obliged to judge. We make judgments all the time. Mostly our judgments are prejudiced and wrong, but we make judgments all the time. The purpose of this kind of thought is to open the world up for critical judgment, not close it down.
Thank you very much, Max.
Well, Ed has rightly argued against false dichotomies, but there are some sort of genuine ones, and it does seem to me that this panel and many other settings show that there is a big, serious division among academics as to whether these modern ideas are progress or not progress. There is a big difference. Why, the question that was raised on the left, where I'm sitting, of whether this debate itself is immoral, did kind of cross my mind. And I do think it is moral for this reason. I think it's very important that we exchange these views and we air these topics in what seems to me to be a reasonably polite and mutually respectful way, rather than, as Goldthorpe has said, the views that have been expressed on both sides are often expressed behind closed doors, and we don't have that debate. And I think it's important that we do have it, and I'm pleased that we have had it this evening.
Thank you very much indeed, Max. And may I say it's been, thank you so many of you for coming. I'm sorry it's been an uncomfortable evening for some of you. You've had to stand throughout. I'd like to say that I've thoroughly enjoyed the evening. I mean, it's fueled all my megalomania to be able to tell, well, even one professor to be quiet, but six, I suppose in Barthes terms, it's sheer jouissance. Anyway, may I thank
all the people on the panel very much and ask you to do the same. Thank you. And good night.